from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History received a very special gift, a magnificent and nearly complete skeleton of a Tyrannosaurus rex, the first T-Rex to grace the museum in Washington. It came from Montana, where it was discovered in 1988. Montana is rich in dinosaur bones. It was a dinosaur playground back in the day. We're digging into that prehistory. This hour, On Point, what was it really like when dinosaurs ruled the earth? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. After all we've seen and read and heard and imagined, what's your question about dinosaurs? Where they gathered, how they lived and died? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Last week, NPR reporter Christopher Joyce went to the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman, Montana, and covered the packing up of that T-Rex.
Down in the basement at the Bozeman Museum, workers are packing the last parts of the local T-Rex bones into wooden crates on the loading dock.
That was then, this is now. T-Rex has arrived. This T-Rex fossilized skeleton has arrived in Washington. We will go to an amateur dinosaur digger this hour who digs in Montana. But first, we have two of the world's leading paleontologists with us right now. Joining us from Bozeman, Montana is John Horner, paleontologist, professor at Montana State University, curator at the Museum of the Rockies. He led the original excavation of the Wankel T-Rex in 1988 in the Charles M. Russell National Wildlife Refuge in Montana, and he oversaw the gift of that T-Rex to the Smithsonian. Just returned from Washington. He's also scientific advisor for all the Jurassic Park movies, was the inspiration for that film's fictional lead paleontologist, Dr. Alan Grant. He's a winner of the MacArthur Genius Grant. John Jack Horner, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you.
And joining us from Chicago is Paul Sereno, celebrated paleontologist and professor at the University of Chicago. He's a National Geographic Society explorer in residence. He discovered dinosaurs on five continents, including a herd of 25 plant-eating dinosaurs in Inner Mongolia and over 100 tons of dinosaur fossils from the Sahara Desert, a legend in the field. Paul Sereno, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Tom.
Jack Horner in Bozeman, Montana, can you describe for us what made the fossilized skeleton that's just traveled to the Smithsonian, this T-Rex, special?
Well, it's special mostly because it's one of the most complete T-Rexes ever found. It's also, you know, of equal size to the Sioux skeleton in Chicago. But most special, I think, is the fact that it was found on public land and therefore is the nation's T-Rex.
What is the scale, the size of this T-Rex skeleton, Jack?
Well, it was about 40 feet long.
And what would that have been in height terms?
Well, it depends on where you measure it. You know, it's dinosaurs walk with their body kind of parallel to the ground. So, you know, 10 feet off the ground.
And if it was rearing up in that Jurassic Park style, I suppose something more than that.
Yeah, and it'd probably break something if it did that.
Paul, okay, we'll talk about that. Paul Sereno, you've got a very famous T-Rex there in Chicago. Sioux, of course, a very, very large one. How common or uncommon is it to find a skeleton as complete as this new T-Rex in the Smithsonian?
Oh, it's quite unusual, and I think Jack works in the state with the motherload of T-Rexes, without a question, where the original one was found, brought to New York. It's unusual to find one that's, really quite complete. This one's about 85%, depending on how you calculate it. Usually when you get an animal that big, the rivers that deposit it deposit a portion of it. Scavengers take some. You're left with piecemeal parts. Sometimes you don't have a skull. So that's what makes this one special. As Jack mentions, you know, they're found on private land. They're found on public land. There's lots of controversies over that. And this is really a super chance for a specimen found in the vast tracts of public land, badlands out in Montana, to be highlighted in another museum.
Jack, what can we tell about this particular T-Rex or not tell? Do we know its gender? Do we know if it died young or old, naturally or unnaturally?
Well, it died around the age of 18. We don't really know how long they lived. I think we have found some T-Rexes that are in the 25 range. Obviously, they grew very fast and probably didn't live any lengthy period of time. This particular one, we do not know the sex of. We don't really know the sex of many different kind, many dinosaurs. In fact, we haven't figured out a really good way of determining sex other than when they're pregnant. There is a tissue called medullary bone that is found on the inside of the tissue. So, we don't, you know, it's a dinosaur it's not a particularly it's not gigantic, it's not little, it's actually an average sized T-Rex.
Just a good healthy T-Rex. Take us back, Jack, if you would, place us first this in time. What was the peak, can we tell, of dinosaur activity in the Montana area? I mean, there were, 100 million years or more, a period during which dinosaurs roamed the Earth? What was the peak of activity in your part of the world, Jack?
Well, we can't really tell about the peak of activity. We have formations that produce a lot of dinosaurs, and so, you know, we only have the snapshots in time that we have, so... the time that T-Rex lived, around 65 to 68 million years ago, we have the Hell Creek Formation that is exposed over much of eastern Montana, western North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, parts of Colorado. And it's a formation that is exposed at the surface of the ground and therefore accessible, and we can get dinosaurs out of it.
Is that why so many skeletons are found in the Montana area? What's unique about it geologically?
That is it, exactly it. Dinosaurs are found, or any fossil is found, where the right age rock is exposed at the surface of the ground. So, you know, the peak of dinosaurs might have been 90 million years ago when we had a period of time that we don't have a lot of sediment exposed at the surface of the ground. So we wouldn't actually have the fossils.
But in Montana, the rock on the ground, practically, that you're walking on is more or less the rock that the dinosaurs walked on.
It is indeed. Most of eastern Montana is the right age rock for dinosaurs. And so not just T-Rexes, but we have rocks between 75 to 80 million years ago that produced other kinds of dinosaurs, other kinds of horned dinosaurs, and other kinds of tyrannosaurs. But we also have Jurassic age rocks from 150 million years ago and early Cretaceous rocks from 120 million years ago. So we have a number of snapshots in time in Montana, and the fact that it's dry and doesn't have a lot of vegetation and has a lot of rivers that cut through those right age sediments gives us all of the right characteristics of places to find dinosaurs.
Paul, how rare is it globally to have those circumstances come together that make Montana such a rich fossil finding area for dinosaurs? Is it very rare? Where else is productive in those terms?
Well, I'm a Chicago boy. Jack is a Montana boy. And when you go to Montana from the big city, I mean, you're just waiting for the state to end. It's so immense, big sky country.
Yes.
And badlands for hundreds of miles. And basically, the amount of area of the formation that Jack was talking about is stupendous. A lot of it badlands, a lot of it the right age. That's why they have the motherlode of Tyrannosaurus, the birthplace of Tyrannosaurus Rex. There's a book out by paleontologists Dingus and Norell on Barnum Brown, who found the first T-Rex specimen. They knew it was special from the very beginning, and it was a monstrous job to pull it out. They knew that when they erected this thing, it would be a sensation. It has remained a sensation ever since 1905 when they did that. And so it's special. North America is special. Montana's, in the center of dinosaur land that stretches from Alberta down to Mexico, and challenged only by China. You have to have the right conditions. There's two things you need for dinosaur preservation. got to be buried in the first place, and then they got to be exposed so you can find them. Mm-hmm. To be buried, you have to have active mountain ranges. So China, North America have had active mountain ranges for much of the dinosaur era over broad stretches of geography. And now a lot of that is still raised up and or dry. And so those about 80% of dinosaurs are found in those two places, China and North America. And then Patagonia, a distant third. And then there's dinosaurs found on every other, you know, continent, but in less greater numbers for the reasons I was mentioning. They didn't have mountain building at the right time. They don't have exposure in some cases.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking as a great new Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton arrives at the Smithsonian in Washington. We're looking at the time when dinosaurs ruled the Earth, especially in this T-Rex's home, Montana. John Jack Horner is with us from the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman, Montana, curator of paleontology there. He was an advisor to the Jurassic Park movies. The paleontologist there kind of modeled on Jack Horner. Paul Sereno is with us as well from Chicago, paleontologist, professor at the University of Chicago, explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. He's discovered dinosaurs on several continents. All kinds of speculation about how it worked. Here's a scene from Jurassic Park. The fictional paleontologist there, Dr. Alan Grant, played by Sam Neill, first sees dinosaurs.
They're moving in herds. They do move in herds.
And the symphony plays behind, of course. And here's Kathy Wankel, the rancher who found the Wankel T-Rex, now in Washington, who it's named after, or was, spoke to NPR last week, said she didn't know what it was until she showed a piece of it. She showed it to a paleontologist, and he said...
He took one look in that box, and his eyes got huge. He said, "You better come with me."
Okay. Jack Horner, that picture in Jurassic Park, you were advising them. I was lucky enough a few years ago to be on Kauai in Hawaii, where I think that was shot high up there, and the dinosaurs, through the magic of TV technological magic, they're running across a high plane, and he's saying they ran in herds. Speculation, or did they?
Well, we have a lot of evidence that that a number of dinosaurs were all dinosaurs appear to have been pretty social. And yes, we do have pretty good evidence that dinosaurs traveled in herds, that they nested in colonies. So, something like that is certainly possible.
Paul, describe to us, maybe it's impossible to know, but do we know when dinosaur populations on Earth were greatest or periods of greatest density?
Well, I think it's really hard to get to population numbers, but I think that they were quite numerous, and their biomass was probably enormous for much of the Mesozoic. I don't know if there'd be any particular time. They seem to be getting, although this could be a geologic artifact, a bit more diverse as time went on during the Mesozoic era. But the evidence, like Jack says, that they herded and were social is pretty overwhelming. The one site that you mentioned where we found ornithomimids, bird-like, sort of ostrich-like dinosaurs, all headed in the same direction, stuck in the mud, was sort of like finding a juvenile herd on flypaper. Many sites are a little bit more reorganized by river flows, but are predominated by species. And so, yeah, they were social, and definitely many of them traveling in herds. And Montana would look different than it does today. It would have there would have been an interior seaway that linked, for most of the Mesozoic, that linked the Hudson Bay with the Gulf of Mexico, and moderated climate. There were no ice caps. And so the terrain where you find T-Rex from Saskatchewan down to Colorado was a verdant shoreline with a delta behind it and some hinterlands that were very fertile and teeming with dinosaurs.
Jack Horner, I'm looking here at a depiction of how Earth might have looked maybe 90 million years ago, but also with this
a great waterway coming down from the north right through the middle of what we now call North America, right down to the Caribbean, so that you have the mountains sort of to the west of that, and then quite a significant waterway, and then what we would think of as the beginning of the Great Plains today. Do we know which side were the greater dinosaur populations on, the mountain side west or the flatter eastern side of that waterway, Jack?
Well, the waterway is the Intercontinental Cretaceous Seaway, and it divided North America into those two parts that we call Laramidia and Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Laramidia that had the active mountain ranges that Paul was talking about. The Appalachian mountain range was already old and not active, so there may have been a lot of dinosaurs living on the east side, but they're not preserved very well. We have a few. We find a few in New Jersey and some other states, but dinosaurs are very rare on the eastern side, but they're very common along the east front of the Rocky Mountains in Laramidia.
Which would have been on the west side of that waterway. Let's go to our listeners. Exactly. Jack, Paul, stand by. Bruce in Quincy, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thanks, Tom. I grew up with a poster on my wall as a kid in the early 60s. And it was just packed full of dinosaurs, many of them renamed. And subsequently, I've learned that predators, you know, aren't very dense, and herbivores are more dense. Are there any calculations as to how many per square mile or square kilometer these critters were back at their peak when they were dominating the world?
Wonderful question, Bruce. Jack Corner in Montana or elsewhere, what about density?
Well, there's really no way to determine that. The fossil record produces what it produces, and that means we're only getting the animals that, as Paul was saying, were preserved. If dinosaurs were in areas that where there was no deposition going on, then we don't have them. So determining the population structure of the actual continents, 65 million years ago, is very difficult to do.
I mean, how do you begin?
Not impossible.
Do you have any kind of mental image of that? I don't know about counterparts. We see safari country, let's say, in East Africa, and have a certain sense of the density of wildebeest or zebra or giraffes or elephants there. At the other extreme, we have, many of us, I'm sure, had posters like our callers, which showed, dinosaurs just all over, sort of on top of each other.
Imagine. So if you look at the Serengeti, and if you think about the fact that the only place that you're actually getting a deposition, and in other words, animals being preserved, are along rivers that flow through it, how much of it are you missing? And that's the problem that we have in any of these ecosystems. We only see animals, we only have animals preserved that died near rivers. And so the animals that lived away from rivers, that didn't fall into rivers and be preserved, we don't have their remains. And so we might find their teeth, but we don't have their skeletons. And so it's very difficult to figure out not only, what the population size was, but what actual species there were.
Paul,
we
do have sometimes... Jack is correct. It's really difficult to calculate standing biomass, this kind of thing. But one thing we can say is when you go to places like Dinosaur National Monument or places where I work in Wyoming in the same formation, Morrison Formation, or places in the Hell Creek Formation, you eventually get data over decades of work in these formations of which dinosaurs live with which dinosaurs and how big they got. And the spectacular thing about T-Rex is that we know that mammalian predators cannot get bigger than about a polar bear and eat meat alone. And so they were doing something different with their physiology to allow them to get bigger. T-Rex was so dominant that there was almost nothing else around its size as a predator. At other times, there's been a few other predators. When we looked at the herbivores, it's just staggering how many there are that bumped into each other. Several different kinds of sauropods, for example, that are larger than the size of an elephant, quite a bit larger, like Brachiosaurus and Apatosaurus and Diplodocus. We have an idea that they lived in the same general geographic areas. So when you think about that, they're doing something more efficient, and there would have been a pretty spectacular diversity of large herbivores to be in the same area at the same time. They were vats of fermenting plants to allow these animals to grow like this, because they didn't have the dentition, the headgear, like mammals, and they didn't have the expensive, quite the expensive metabolism, cell by cell. And so it would have been spectacular, and I think it really would have been different. There's some basic differences in the dinosaur world if you traveled back in time and arrived on the scene from our mammal-dominated world. And one of them is the size of these animals and their density.
It's very intriguing when you say that predators today, mammalian predators, have a certain kind of high end or around polar bear size, and that the Tyrannosaurus rex and others then, predators, would have been doing something different with their physiology to get so big. Like what?
Well, I mean, it basically comes down to how much energy per cell you put out. An elephant is putting out enough energy per cell as a typical mammal with stamina and all the rest that goes along with its physiology, that it really has to worry about cooling itself off with big ears and no hair and all this kind of stuff. And it's eating all day long. It's a very expensive physiology. It can't really scale much larger than that. There was a rhinoceros that got a bit larger, but in the distant past on land. And you go on water, and then the limits are larger for both predators and herbivores. But on land, that seems to be it. You look at an elephant, it is eating all day long, and it's trying to get rid of the heat. There was some kind of mass operation going on in dinosaurs where the volume kept the body temperature up, and they were doing something a little more efficiently in terms of processing the food and cell-by-cell energy savings over a mammal to allow them to get to this size, to allow them to get to this diversity at that size in these times in the past.
Jack Horner, do you see the scale, the size of dinosaurs as having been primarily a matter of cell biology, perhaps a different kind of biology, or of their environment, or a combination?
Well, you know, Paul is right. I mean, they're very different, and it's kind of like comparing mammals to birds. Birds have a very different physiology than mammals do. We say they're both warm-blooded, but we oftentimes speak of them both being endothermic homeotherms, but they're not. Birds actually can fluctuate their temperature by tremendous amount, 30 degrees. Us mammals, we fluctuate by 4 degrees and we have to go to the hospital. If you can imagine being able to change your temperature by 30 degrees, then obviously you don't have to eat as much. We eat all the time. Elephants eat all the time, so they can maintain their, you know, 4 degree, their temperature that has to remain exact, whereas a lot of birds can just, you know, turn down their temperature, and then they don't have to eat so much. So they can, you know, do things very different than mammals. And I think dinosaurs basically had the same physiology we see with birds now.
A lot of us have heard the word lately that birds are the descendants of dinosaurs. One listener asks you here, Jack, was the depiction of the T-Rex accurate in Jurassic Park, or did the T-Rex have feathers? And what about that relationship?
Young T-Rexes probably had feather-like structures, and older T-Rexes may have had some of that as well. But the depiction of T-Rex in Jurassic Park is an actor.
is there a connection between the T-Rex and a chicken?
Well, of course. You know, all birds are related. They have a common ancestor, and that common ancestor is within the Dinosauria. So dinosaurs, birds are dinosaurs. Birds technically are dinosaurs. And Paul is a good person to talk about this subject, because he's into the relatedness of dinosaurs.
If chickens are dinosaurs, Paul, why do they fit in a hen house?
Well, you know, they were actually at that size for half of the dinosaur era. And they got a bit bigger, but and sometimes they lost flight and got quite a bit bigger than even a moa. But you know, they specialized in flight and in general, and invaded all sorts of habitats and got giant, even bigger eggs, and you know, and so they're still with us today, and they outnumber the mammals. If you're looking at the race between dinosaurs and mammals, I mean, we still have twice as many dinosaurs alive today, about 10,000 species, than we do mammals. But you know, Jack is right, and a lot of it is historical accident. We found, you know, there's a very influential book. No one had found a wishbone in a dinosaur, and a very influential anatomist said, "Well, you know, if dinosaurs don't have a wishbone, almost all birds have wishbones." Mm. You know, they can't fuse clavicles. They can't be descended from dinosaurs. And then, of course, we started finding wishbones right and left over time. And now we've found an amazing discoveries in lake beds, feathers, and tyrannosaurs, a bit older than T-Rex, with downy-like feathers covering their bodies, and even big ones. And so everything in between. And had that discovery occurred earlier, I think we would have grown up with dinosaurs giving rise to birds, birds being technically, as Jack says, dinosaurs.
Why are they not as big as dinosaurs were then? If they are the descendants of dinosaurs, why are they so puny now?
Well, I mean, as there was a time, for example, in South America where there was the top raptor was a giant, elephant-like bird that went around terrorizing everything else.
Yeah.
I think that they've specialized. I mean, you got to give it to them. They go from the poles to pole. They swim. They fly. They're in every habitat. They flock. They migrate thousands of miles. They may not be the biggest on land, the biggest herbivores, or the biggest predators on land anymore. But you got to give it to them. They still have the upper edge and diversity and an amazing range of habitats. They are the best flyers. They put bats to shame and as mammals. And so they're really amazingly diverse. But the largest land-dwelling animals took an asteroid, get dislodged. And at that point, some of the small mammals, they kept mammals at bay for 100 million years as small mouse or slightly larger than mouse-sized animals.
Yeah.
And it took an asteroid to dislodge them, and then, with the exception of some reptiles, crocodilians and turtles hung around. But the main land animals changed, but birds got through and are with us today. So, you know, they're successful. They don't dominate in body size on land, but highly successful group.
Paul Sereno, stand by in Chicago. It's great to have you here. Jack Horner, I know I have to lose you in just half a minute here. As people soon, I suppose, begin to flock to Washington to see your wonderful gift there, this Tyrannosaurus rex, what do you hope they're thinking about as they gaze upon its mighty skeleton?
I just hope that it inspires kids to get into science and into evolutionary biology, paleontology. Well, basically any of the sciences that are cool.
Come on in and help us learn. Jack Horner oversaw the gift of this T-Rex out of Montana to the Smithsonian. He's curator of paleontology at the Museum of the Rockies, joining us today from Bozeman, Montana. John, Jack Horner, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As a great new Tyrannosaurus rex skeleton arrives at the Smithsonian in Washington, we're looking at the time when dinosaurs ruled the earth, especially in Montana, this T-Rex's home. Paul Sereno joins us, paleontologist, professor at the University of Chicago. He has discovered dinosaurs, well, all over the place, on continents all around the world. 800-423-8255 to bring your question to Paul. Mark Tarner joins us in just a minute, amateur paleontologist who's done work in Montana as well. Robbie's calling right now from Boston. Hi, Robbie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Great Hi. Show.
Great.
I was calling because I live, as you know, in Massachusetts, and there's an area out along the Connecticut River, Springfield-Connecticut line, where you can actually see dinosaur tracks that go down into what is now the river. And then further south along 91, I think it was when they were excavating for 91, they uncovered this rather large area where you can clearly see what was once mud very well-preserved dinosaur tracks, on some of which you can see the scales on their feet. And I don't know if people in the Massachusetts, Connecticut, East Coast area know it. It's a beautiful place.
It's wonderful. I have not seen them, but it's wonderful just to imagine. Robbie, thanks for calling. Paul, what about it? How do you find tracks still all over the place? In certain parts of the world, most common? How do you know when they are dinosaur tracks?
They're sometimes tricky. I get calls every week about finding a dinosaur track or an eyeball in their backyard, and you know, a lot of these are difficult to interpret. But no, in fact, those tracks were known from the 19th century. A man named Hitchcock made a big collection now in the Amherst at the college in Amherst. Pratt Museum, beautiful trackways because the conditions were just right in the Connecticut Valley in the Triassic period some 200 million years ago to preserve these dinosaur tracks. And this was, of course, before dinosaurs were really even named, early part of the 19th century. And he rightfully so likened them to large birds making these tracks. Many of them were three-toed. As the caller mentions, you can see them. There's spectacular tracks of dinosaurs coming, sitting down, getting up, and walking off the side. You need the right conditions. You need a nice subsurface that's wet, like clay or wet sand, and then it's got to bake after the track is made, and then it gets filled in with something else. And if it's in an area where it's being sediment is accumulating, you can get these amazing trackways.
Robbie, thanks for your call. Mildred in Bristol, Rhode Island. Mildred, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. What I'm wondering is, what if the dinosaurs hadn't gone extinct? They would have had millions of years and lots of millions of years to evolve. And can you speculate what might have happened next? Would they get just bigger, or what could have happened?
If not for the asteroid, would they have developed humanoid intelligence? We'd be scaly or something? What do you say, Paul?
Well, I thank Tom for that inference, because that's always what we think, because we're vain creatures.
Yes, of course.
We have been, ever since we started talking to ourselves and writing things down.
Yeah.
So we want truly to see ourselves as the most advanced, the most the end and be all of evolution. But when we take a sober look at the fossil record, we find otherwise. So we find that we're once multiple species. We're the last surviving twig, almost went extinct at a very low population at a point before, while we were talking and had all of our anatomy, before we actually gained in numbers and ultimately with the advent of civilization sort of began to change the world and environment around us. Dinosaurs? No, we know what would happen if they had a language box, if they had an enlarged forebrain, if they were social and communicated, if some of them even made tools. We know what they would be. They'd be birds. That's what they, there's nothing. We're very bad at predicting what would happen in evolution. We can tell from the fossil record what happened, and we can tell some rules of the game. You're going to go extinct no matter what. Your species can't last more than about 4 or 5 million years with the exigencies of life around us. No dinosaur species did. No mammal species ever did. And so you have to give rise to new species, or your lineage goes extinct. We know that as a rule. But what you'd become, we know that the environment fills up. But one of the most amazing things, still not studied very well about the dinosaur era, is that there's nothing like a great ape there hanging around in the trees, that big body mass. There's nothing like an aardvark or an armadillo digging burrows on all four legs. There's nothing like, a sea cow. These are mammal creations in a four-legged radiation. There's nothing, of course, like a human. We do know when, a lot of these animals had expanded forebrains. Some of them had semi-opposable thumbs. They had a lot of the equipment that we later embellished. And, there are some birds with dialects. They have a syrinx, very much like our larynx. Mm-hmm. They communicate. They use tools sometimes. Amazing show on Nova showing how intricate the tools that birds can make. So to make a long answer short, despite the fact that every science show with Martians, the Martian ends up looking like a human, this is the most improbable thing that would evolve, an upright stance of an animal without whiskers going through the environment with a big swollen head. This is a very improbable outcome. So I think dinosaurs would have persisted. They would have been the main carnivores and herbivores on land. But I don't think that anything like a human would have appeared.
Let me ask you then here. Adam writes to us, says, I'd like to hear about the relationship between early mammals and the great predatory dinosaurs like the T-Rex. I don't know if that's the right way to frame it, but what about those early mammals and the dinosaur population? What do we know about their interaction?
We've learned an awful lot. It's a perfectly right way to phrase it. Mammals and dinosaurs began about the same time, believe it or not, early part of the Mesozoic, in the earliest stages of the Triassic period. I've gone to dig the earliest dinosaurs, and we find them in North America, and the very earliest ones down in just on the north edge of Patagonia, north of Patagonia, in a place called Ishuguilasto.
What kind of mammals?
Well, they don't look like modern mammals. The closest example would be something like a rodent. They are developing some of the precise occlusion with the teeth and the replacement of the teeth during the Mesozoic that characterized this group. There were many different kinds, and out of that potpourri of rat and more like mouse-sized animals came the mammals that we know today, the placentals and the marsupials. Mm-hmm. There's a few stragglers, the duck-billed platypus and the echidna, that still lay eggs. They actually don't have all of the mammal features, but they have some of them. There's like halfway in between, and they waddle around. And then there's the mammals we know today that got upright on their legs, are agile. And so they look like little mouse-sized animals. They were very diverse, especially in North America. You can literally go out to the T-Rex beds if you have a keen eye. Sometimes you need a sieve,
okay,
and you can find their teeth.
Wow, they were not exactly big competitors. Dave writes to us on Twitter, says, what was the point of T-Rex tiny little arms? And he adds, do you suppose they were mocked? Could that explain their bad attitude?
No. You know, I think that I wrote a paper about this because we found, you know, there was a lot said about the tiny arms. Was it runaway evolution with the head getting enormous and the arms getting smaller and the animal lost control of its own genes? And, you know, is this a case of allometry and, you know, changing body proportions out of control? And what we found was a small T-Rex. I called it Raptor Rex. It comes from Asia and had the same proportions. It was only about 9 feet long, had tiny forearms, big, lanky, running legs, and
so what do you mean?
This was a So basically, what I come to understand is that this is not runaway evolution. It's a trade-off in a bipedal animal that walks, as Jack was saying earlier, with its back horizontal to the ground. You got cantilevered out from your hips, arms, and a head. You can't never in predators do you have an enormous head and enormous arms, powerful arms. It's one or the other, or both are moderate.
Now, why is that again? Explain the physics here that would bring it.
You've got all this weight cantilevered out in front of the. Yeah, I mean, this is going to fall on its nose.
I see. Already those huge legs are required to kind of keep everything pivoting and balanced. If you got that big,
you got a big tail.
You can't, and you got a big tail, but you can't have a big head and arms, or it just topples forward.
That's right. And T-Rex basically said, I'm going to do everything with my jaws pretty much. Now, that said, because it does have a stupendous head, it's about 6 feet, the biggest one's almost 6 feet in length, but it's the girth, the volume, even though they pump it full of air, it's a massive, massive killing device with 6-inch teeth, powerful jaw muscles. That's a good amount of mass in the farthest point from the hips. So the arms have to be per se small. Now, when you get up close to one of those arms, you gain a little respect. Right. They are as long as yours, only the humerus is easily 2 to 3 times the diameter of your humerus, your upper arm bone. The thing could have curled, we estimate, 600 pounds.
Okay.
And it had vicious claws. So these are not, it couldn't feed, it couldn't reach its mouth, but these would cling on. And these would be devastating, you know, to anybody that got close to them.
Respect for the so-called tiny arms of the Tyrannosaurus Rex. Paul Cirino, stand by in Chicago. I want to welcome into our conversation, if I may, from South Bend, Indiana, Mark Tarner. Mark's an amateur paleontologist. He's president of the South Bend Chocolate Company, but when it's digging time, he heads out. He's been unearthing all kinds of stuff. We'll be in Montana this summer. Mark Tarner, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
How many weeks a year do you spend looking for dinosaur fossils, bones?
You know, I try to hide as many from my wife as possible, but it's 4 to 6.
And is Montana happy hunting grounds for you?
Yeah, I have a lot of great relationships out there, mostly in eastern Montana. And, you know, there's, I think, and Paul might correct me, but I think the largest number of dinosaurs in North America have come out of Montana.
Where do you tend to look for what out there when you go, Mark?
You know, normally the ranchers lead me right to where the area where they've discovered something. But, you know, there are certain bands. We hunt the Hell Creek, and it's very noticeable, sort of a grayish-green band in the hills.
How do you know when you're on to something that's not, you know, a couple of piles of old cattle bones?
You don't. You know, there's an obvious difference between cattle bones and fossils. One's heavy and a stone, you know. But normally you chase, 99% of the time, you chase a bone fragment up a hill where it's eroded out, Tom, and there's, you know, you come up empty. It's just kind of the laws of, you know, probability.
And when it's a great find, I presume there's something protruding from the earth and you begin carefully digging around it and find or could find what, Mark?
Yeah, we found a nice duckbill that has some skin and looks like a lot of skin on the tail. And we found two vertebrae at the base of a butte and chased it right up the butte and found a fully articulated tail. And we've dug it out up to the hips. But we have to be really careful because of all the skin impressions.
Now, there's some controversy about who's digging for what in Montana and elsewhere these days. You've got amateur diggers like yourself, Mark. You've got commercial diggers. Last fall, there were these two fossilized dinosaur skeletons found in Montana on a ranch in 06 on the auction block in New York City, expected to fetch then $7 or $8, $9 million. What do you do with the skeletons, the fossils that you find, Mark?
You know, I'm a collector, and I think, at least in North America, there's a tremendous, you know, a lot of the amateurs and the ranchers actually find the fossils, you know, and there's seems to be a great relationship between the amateur community and the professional paleontologist. I don't know so much about the commercial people. I'm actually looking for a museum that will take the fossil, or I'd like to bring it back to South Bend. There's a small university here called Notre Dame that might want to not only have a great football team, but a great paleontology program. So I really can't speak to that.
Paul Sereno, what about the relationships here between amateur diggers like Mark, ranchers, paleontologists, and the auction block, Paul?
Well, first let me say I live on the border of Indiana and Illinois, so and I'd be very interested in your bones.
But, okay, Paul.
Come on over.
you know, it's I run a class, Dinosaur Science, out in just south of Wyoming, south of Montana border in Wyoming. And, you know, to give the chance to inner-city kids, much less college kids or just amateurs in general, the chance to dig is one of the greatest thrills of a lifetime. It's you really there's nothing that you can read in a book that can give you the feel of what it's like to walk in the footsteps of a tyrannosaur, as it were, back in time and realize that this bone is 60, 70, 100 million years old, and you're actually excavating it and back in that day. So yeah, there's a there's a good relation as Mark says, and then there's some controversy because we have a strong tradition of private property in the United States and in other countries, many other countries, that's not the case. And so you might be compensated for bones, but you can't own them like you can't own archaeological artifacts. And in our country, we view them more as if you're found on private land. Now, a lot of the ranchers do find, as was said, do find finds. Their land is often divided between public land that they're leasing the surface rights on and private land. And so there's sort of an agreement, but an uneasy agreement, because where you find something, of course, in the light of the $8 million sale of Sue, and you mentioned another sale for $9 million, everyone thinks you're going to get rich, and it's really quite difficult to make sensible money on fossils. It's very hard. I think the other person online would agree. It's very hard to find really good specimens, and a lot of work to get them out. And so, you know, there's a market and sometimes disagreements, as there was over the T-Rex Sue, over who owns what, where it was found, that kind of a thing sometimes. And fossils get lost in the mix sometimes. And so, but, you know, there's great opportunities through museums and through ranchers that that want to allow digging on their ranch if they found something. I mean, you really have to go to the middle of almost nowhere to find somebody that doesn't know about dinosaurs and know what they look like. That's why there's so many finds being made today. I did find a few of these people. They're in the middle of the Sahara, and they never saw a dinosaur. But, you know, basically, that's where you have to go.
Hey, Mark Tarner, you've dug up a lot. Have you ever imagined yourself being set down in the midst of those dinosaurs when they still roam the Earth? How long do you think your posse would have lasted out there, Mark?
Oh, I'd just throw some chocolate at them, and they'd probably go for that instead of an overweight Midwesterner.
Oh, you sound like a nice tea time snack, Mark. Those little arms would be all over you, baby.
I don't think so.
Well, maybe not. We hear your joy in bringing these fossils to light, and we share in it. Mark Tarner, we thank you for sharing a little bit of your experience with us today from South Bend, Indiana. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Paul Sereno at the University of Chicago, paleontologist there, world-renowned. Paul, thank you for sharing your dinosaur insights with us today. Wonderful to have you here.
You're most welcome.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. ¶¶